Thank you for joining us for this episode of Talking with Religious Historians. This is a short-form episode of our regular Ecclesiastical History Society podcast, wherein we talk to established religious historians to find out more about their careers and what advice they would give early career researchers. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Betts, a historian of early modern British medicine and religion. Thank you for joining us today. For today's episode, we are happy to welcome Professor Craig Harleen. He is a professor of history at Brigham Young University, teaching courses on the Reformation, the history of civilization, and the history of Christianity. His research focuses on the religious history of Europe since the Middle Ages, which he's pursued in archives all across Europe, including Belgium, France, and Germany. His publications have been reviewed in mainstream and academic media alike, including his most recent book, A World Ablaze, The Rise of Martin Luther and the Birth of the Reformation, published in 2017. Today, Professor Harleen joins us to share his experience of academia and advice on how to start a new research project, especially one outside of your area of expertise. Professor Harleen, thank you for joining us on today's episode.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, we're so happy to have you. So to kick us off, would you mind discussing your academic background and how you came to academia?
Mostly I came to it through the study of religion itself, because I grew up in California and was sent on a mission, a Mormon mission, to Belgium when I was 19. And when I was in Belgium, I couldn't believe, as an American, that everyone seemed to belong to one religion. And second, as a Mormon, that if they had to choose anything, it would be Catholicism. So that was my introduction. And of course, the longer I was there for 2 years, the more I understood Catholicism and the more interested I got in it. And when I went back to university, there was a class offered in the Reformation. I hadn't thought yet of studying history, but I saw this class in the Reformation, and I couldn't think of anything that I would rather study. All of a sudden, it seemed like everything was coming together there. So I took that class, and then I was hooked from then on. And from then, went on to graduate school and got a PhD in European history. And yeah, that's how I began, I suppose.
That's great. I like that going abroad and seeing different ways of life was that inspiration. That's amazing. So you are a very prolific writer, and you've written books such as A Bishop's Tale, Matthias Hofius Among His Flock in 17th Century Flanders, Conversions, Two Family Stories from the Reformation in Modern America, and Miracles at the Jesus Oak, Histories of the Supernatural in Reformation Europe, just to name a few. Can you tell us a bit more about your latest book, which is on Martin Luther?
Right. That seems like it was published forever ago now, since I'm now working on another. But yes, in 2017, I think every publisher wanted to have a book about Martin Luther for the 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses. So Oxford University Press approached me about writing such a thing, and I found it so bizarre because I said, you know, I'm not a specialist in Martin Luther. I mostly study, you know, Netherlandish French history. And they said, we know. And I said, oh, really? And they said, yes, we want somebody who is not a specialist to write something that is for general readership and so on. Not that a specialist couldn't do that. I thought Lyndall Roper's book was great, for instance, about Martin Luther. And there were others that I liked too, and Peter Marshall's and so on. But I said, you know, I might be interested in that because I've always written about obscure people. And so maybe I should take on the challenge of writing about someone famous. And so I thought about it for a while, and I decided I would do that. And I think they figured that somebody who wasn't an expert would maybe present it in a way, focus on things that other people, also not expert, would be interested in. So that's what I tried to do. And I didn't really feel like I'd have a whole lot to add to what specialists understood about Luther. But the one thing I saw as I read in the many, many biographies of him and many studies of him, was that it had become very hard to write about Luther as something other than a monument. And I thought, why not tell the story more from the point of view as if he didn't know what was going to happen next, or nobody knows what's going to happen next. It's very hard to write about someone that famous without looking into the future and knowing, you know, how the story was going to unfold. And so I tried to have this illusion, right, or this sense that we didn't know. So I tried to write the story that way, as if we didn't know what was going to happen. And they also wanted me to focus, I think that was a good idea, to focus on the first few years just before he became famous, to show how he became famous. And of course, that itself is looking at the story a little bit backwards. But within those parameters, I tried to do that as much as I could, tried to tell the story looking forwards and instead of backwards. So that was a, yeah, that was the thing that I thought was interesting. It was interesting to me to try to construct it that way and to try to learn all those details. I had taught Luther dozens of times in courses on the Reformation and so on, but I had never done it in this much detail. And I found it really interesting myself. And, you know, having done it once, I was glad I studied someone who was famous for once. But I was glad to go back to my obscure people, too.
Well, it sounds like writing about those people with, you know, maybe more ordinary lives than Martin Luther was really helpful in this case in writing about somebody famous. So that sounds really, really interesting. And I'm going to tag your book below in the description of this podcast so people can go check that out. But if there was one thing that you feel like you learned about writing this book on Martin Luther that was just really exciting or really new or very different for you, what would that be?
Well, there were some pleasant and some unpleasant things, I suppose. The unpleasant thing was I didn't like writing on a deadline, and it had to be done by November 2016 in order to be ready on time for the 2017 festivities. That wasn't very fun. I just realized this. I hadn't really had to do that before, and it was a tighter deadline than I'd ever had before. But I also realized I could do it. And it also made me realize that, especially someone like Luther, who left behind so many papers, and some people said, you know, more has been written about him than anyone except Jesus Christ. With that many papers, you have to find something. And so that was a challenge, to learn how to sort through so many documents and write something of a reasonable page limit as well. And I think it was mostly really learning that story, as I was saying, looking at it forwards instead of backwards. I mean, it was exciting for me to see how those things were proceeding and to feel like, you know, we didn't know how this was going to go, to feel kind of the desperation in Luther even. I felt like I was able to sense that myself, and I hopefully conveyed that in the book.
That's great. Thank you. Well, let's move on to your project now, because we're back to talking about non-famous people. And your current project is about migration spiritually and physically, which just that already has arrested me. But it's set in the modern period.
Yeah.
And can you explain more about this project and why you're working on a book set in the modern period instead of your period, which is the early modern?
Right. Except for the Luther book and the guy wrote on the history of Sunday, a kind of big survey of Sunday. Those are the only projects that have been commissioned or somebody's asked me to do them. All the other books have just kind of happened. They've just kind of been fortuitous, serendipitous, whatever you want to call it. And that was the case with this latest project as well. I hadn't planned on doing a book on the modern world at all. And it was actually, just before I started doing the research on Luther, I had to interrupt this project in order to do Martin Luther. But, you know, I was glad to do it because I wanted to try. But in a couple of years before then, I came into contact with four siblings, American siblings, whose mother had recently died and left a whole bunch of documents behind. And they couldn't read them because they were mostly in her native languages. She was from Belgium, and they were in Dutch and also French, even some Latin. She spoke a lot of languages. And they wanted to know what was in these documents. And there's a long story how they found me. But anyway, I said, sure, I'd be glad to take a look at some of them and let them know what was in them and maybe even recommend the project to someone who studied the modern world. So I flew out to Santa Barbara, where the deceased woman's daughter lived, and she had the bulk of the papers. I flew out there to take a look at them. And within about 10 minutes, really, I decided I wanted to write this book. The very rash decision.
Oh, that's a quick turnaround.
I did not take this as a rational sort of thing. It was more of something intuitive, I suppose, that I felt like I wanted to do. On the other hand, it wasn't as if it came out of absolutely nowhere, because in 2011, I published a book on a very similar theme, which was conversions. You mentioned it in the introduction. And in that book, I got interested in the theme that had started in the Reformation, which was what happens when people convert to their familial relationships, because somebody is always affected. If you're maybe your whole family, immediate family converts, but what about your extended family? Or most often somebody within a family converts, and what happens to their relationships with their immediate family? Or people quit faith altogether, whatever. You can go in all kinds of different directions. And of course, that was something that was practically invented in the Reformation. There hadn't been much choice in religion since, I suppose, the early medieval world, maybe since the ancient world, or when it came to Christianity. So I thought this, you know, there had been a number of studies on how cities had coped, how states had coped. Most Reformation classes are organized around, you know, we go from no religious tolerance to limited tolerance to, you know, greater tolerance. But I felt like one theme I hadn't read much about was what happens in that most intimate social setting of families. So that's what I wanted to study. Anyway, I ended up publishing that book, which was about especially a 17th century young man, son of a Protestant preacher, Reformed preacher, who converted to Catholicism and kept a secret diary, part of it in code, which is how I became interested in, you know, or found a project, a specific project to pursue that theme. And anyway, I wrote that book in 2011 and was already interested in that theme. And so when I saw that this new study of these new documents from this woman who had died in 2010 were on a similar theme, and that she had left behind even more documents than my 17th century young man with his coded journal, I was just really hooked. And I decided I wanted to do it myself. And that was a big decision and an almost immediate decision. But she was especially a spiritual journal that this woman, whose name was Anaïs, she had left behind this journal that she kept between 1941 and 1948. And just reading that immediately grabbed me. And then there were so many other papers, all her school papers, a lot of letters that she had written and received, other kinds of documents, a lot of really great photographs. And I felt like I had the sense that here's the same theme, because there's also this conversion that's involved and also unsettled relationships with, you know, her family. And I didn't know the outcome of it, but I knew that was, I could already tell this was part of the problem. So it was really kind of these two journals, the 17th century journal, and then this journal of this woman Anaïs, that got me going and made me feel like, you know, there might be a whole book here. So that's how I decided to study this new one.
That's great. When I was listening to you speak about this, all of Anaïs's letters and documents and everything, it sounds like there's a good amount of her papers. And that kind of reflected what you said about Martin Luther and having so many of his papers. Do you feel like you got a sense of who Anaïs really was or who Luther really was? Or do you think that as a historian, that's maybe out of our reach a bit?
Oh, I think probably only novelists can dare to imagine exactly what somebody is thinking and feeling and imagining. I don't think there's ever enough for a historian to try to surmise that. You can hint at it, you can get a sense of it for sure. And especially with Luther, or for anybody where there are a lot of documents, people have done that or use psychological theory and so on. It's always interesting as well. In this case, I think it was, well, let's put it this way. With Luther, there were an awful lot of documents, probably just as many as for this modern woman Anaïs, but they have been so thoroughly, you know, mined and used by historians, not that you can't always find something new to say, but a lot of angles of his inner life have been explored. And what I sensed with Anaïs and all these documents was that I had far more than I had for any other obscure person of the Reformation. And so that's what interested me, was what would it be like to try to understand as much as we can based on documents? What moves somebody to change religions when it almost always causes so much trouble? And also how somebody might manage the trouble that arises. And she did that quite well. And so I thought, here's somebody who can address this theme from the Reformation, but she's a 20th century person. And I thought, here's a chance to study the Reformation sort of obliquely, right? Here's a classic Reformation problem, something practically invented in the Reformation. Somebody changes religions. And then how does she manage that with her loved ones? And that's the theme that, as I said, has really interested me since that time. And you don't solve it with one book or two books or 100 books. There's always a different set of circumstances, there's always a new story to tell. And they always have the same dynamic. And the dynamic is, are you going to choose your relationships or your convictions? Or how are you going to negotiate those two? Can you keep both of those somehow? And every story goes a little bit differently. And that's what makes it interesting to me, that there's this theme of continuity, this idea of what are you going to choose? But there's also this constant variation as well. So variations on a theme.
The way you've described it there, it's very narrative driven to have, which are you going to choose? And knowing that everybody has a different choice to make, and really diving into that in particular example, I think is just such an interesting parallel to the Reformation. I just love it.
Right. It seemed like I could answer more though than in the Reformation. I mean, I had a lot of documents for my 17th century story conversions. I did have quite a few documents, relatively speaking, but not nearly as many as I had for Anais. And so that's what made me feel like I could perhaps get even deeper. But again, I don't know that you ever quite figure everything out, but I could understand it even more deeply than I could for this Reformation character.
I think as somebody who typically studies the Reformation, that just must have felt like such a goldmine, having that many, that much access to somebody's papers.
Exactly.
So incredible.
That's exactly how I felt. And you'd think my experience with Martin Luther would have prepared me for this, of how to deal with an abundance of documents. But again, it's a little different because these are all unknown documents. And so I didn't have any secondary sources also to help guide me. I mean, I looked at primary sources when I was working with Luther because so many of them were printed. But there are a lot of secondary sources from which I could also develop my narrative. And with this, there's not that. And so I wish I would have spoken with someone actually who studies modern history to try to get a sense of how to manage this unbelievable number of documents, the likes of which I've never had before. And so it really slowed me down. And this project has probably taken me longer than any other one out here. I thought it was going to be simpler.
I love the optimism at the beginning of projects.
One writer once described it as, when you start a project and you have it in your mind, you know, it's this cathedral of fire. You know, the possibilities are endless. It's going to be this big, beautiful thing. But then the further you go, it kind of fizzles out to maybe a tiny flame on a match or something. You know, just a solid if the realities begin to hit you.
They really do. But it leads me to my next question, which is great, because you did have this project that is outside of what you know, your normal time period and normally what you would write. And I would just love to pick your mind for lessons that you learned from that and what you could tell other people maybe when they're beginning a project outside of what they did their PhD on or their normal area of expertise. How do you go about starting that?
Yeah, I suppose it depends which period you're moving from and to. Moving from the early modern period to the 20th century, again, was the shock of the unbelievable number of documents I had to deal with. So, yeah, it might help to get some advice from people. How do you manage that? Instead of having to read every single one, and, you know, is there another strategy that you might take? The other would be that it's no small thing to learn the wider world in which your specific events occur. I think when we study a particular period, we kind of think the world revolves around that time period, and we're aware of all the other periods and we know something about them, because, you know, we're historians, but you almost forget all the work it takes to learn that bigger context and that informs your specific story. You don't necessarily use all that context, but you need to know it. So you have to have this kind of frame or context built up in your head while you're writing or before you even start writing. And that takes a lot of time. So you have to, it's something you should do when you have time to do it. You shouldn't do it early in your career, I think, unless you're really completely switching fields. But for me, I'm just switching for this one project. And then I have a project planned. My next project will be set back in the 17th century. But, you know, you just have to have a lot of respect for the field that you're moving to, I think, and not take it lightly.
Now, in your case, because you had the idea based on primary sources that you had available to you, did you read all of those primary sources first?
I did read them. I mean, I read some secondary sources along the way. It's always a chicken and egg question, right? The one helps you understand the other better. Once you understand your period better, you can go back and see those documents in a different way. But yeah, there's no perfect solution to do that. So I did read through all of them. And that, I sometimes wonder if that was a mistake or not, just because there are so many, and so many that won't be useful either. But, you know, I don't mind it. I still really like the project. A project that takes a long time kind of hangs on you and you feel like, oh, I'll be happy when it's finally done. But I think the trick is to try to find some contentment as you're working.
Right.
And not feel like when it's done, then I'll be happy. Right. It's more you have, otherwise you'll just drive yourself crazy with something.
Now, can I ask the question, when will this be out for everybody to read?
I'll probably finish writing it in 2024, probably. And then so it'll probably be out, you know, a year or so after that. It will still be a while, but it's been a massive project just to organize the materials and then to kind of pick out what's most interesting, because it's not like we want a multi-volume work from something like this, right? It's got to be condensed. What's the essential thread of the story? And so it takes a while to work that out. I mean, the basic narrative I knew pretty early on. I mean, not in the first 10 minutes, but, you know, in the first couple of weeks or so, that when she was a young Catholic girl, she badly wanted to enter a convent. And her mother was fiercely against that because it was an enclosed convent. And, you know, respectable middle class girls did not do such a thing, especially if they had her kind of intelligence and talent. Maybe she could have entered a teaching convent or a hospital convent. But anyway, so there's a breach with her mother right there. And they struggled for 7 years. And finally, she decides that she's going to enter, and she sets a date just before she enters the convent. In fact, 2 weeks before she enters the convent, Mormon missionaries come up to their door and they come to rent a room in her family's house because her family rented rooms. That was how they made their living. And her mother was so desperate that she asked the missionaries, can you please try to talk my daughter out of entering the convent? And of course, they're eager to do something like this, right? But Anais, on the other hand, is thinking that she's going to convert the missionaries to Catholicism. So it goes back and forth over the next couple of weeks. But by the time the date arrives for her to enter the convent, she's so confused, she decides to postpone it to a couple months. And then she postpones it another couple months. And by then, she's decided to convert to Mormonism. She ends up writing the missionary. He goes home to Idaho. He's from a farm in Idaho, and she's from Ghent, Belgium, right? Two completely different worlds. And they write for a year, and she decides to go see him in Idaho. There's no internet or anything like that, and no cheap plane flights. And she goes there for 6 months to see how it works. She has a six-month visa. And it works out just before her visa expires. They get married, and she stays in the U.S. Eventually have four children, and three of those children leave the Mormon church. So she has to reconcile with her parents who stay Catholic, and she has to reconcile with her children who leave the religion that she's given up everything for, right? When she immigrates to the U.S., she loses her community, she loses her language, she loses her old religion, which she really did love. I mean, she wanted to be a nun. She was serious about it too. But anyway, in the book, I get into the reasons, you know, the intricacies of why she converts and all the psychology going on and so on. But she successfully navigates this with her parents. She has a great relationship with her parents, even though there's some really awful moments. And then she navigates it with her children, with other awful moments, you know, as they grow up. She has all these hopes, you know, with her husband. She's emigrating, giving up everything, and has this vision of an ideal family, and it doesn't quite go that way. But she keeps great relationships with her children as well. I thought it was a great story to try to explore that theme of relationships.
It is. What an interesting life, and just what an amazing story. I see why it only took you 10 minutes. I mean, this is fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it took me longer than that to figure the story out, but I could feel the possibilities, I think, just in the emotion. And she's very literary, and it's a beautiful journal. And the way she expressed herself and so on, she wrote a lot of poetry. So I could feel that, you know, the potential for it early on, but I didn't really understand that it would carry into the generation of her children at the time. And that's also a really interesting part of the story for me. Yeah, that's what sold it for me, really, because in every faith, you can find interesting conversion stories and write impossible conversion stories. But it was the fact that she kept those relationships with her parents and with her children that really sold me on it, made me want to do it in the end, even though I had this impulse right away to write about her. I think what sold me on it when I had to think about it rationally was that she was able to do that. And I think this is a really relevant theme in the world today, not just for religion. Of course, there are still religious differences that divide us. We like to think we're so tolerant now and you know, we wouldn't be divided by something like that. But some people still are. It's mostly politics, though. Politics, sexuality, whatever, any of these things present precisely the same question. Are you going to choose your relationships or are you going to choose your convictions, right? And so, to me, it's a really relevant theme, whether it happens to take the specific form of religion or not.
That's beautiful. And I know that we'll all be waiting at the EHS to see it come out. I'm very much looking forward to reading it. So thank you for telling us about it.
Sure.
I have one final question for you.
Sure.
It is, what is your favorite part about being an academic?
I think finding new documents, the research part, is always the most interesting. Because, again, the cathedral of fire starts forming in your head, right? It's like, oh, this is fantastic. With this, I can do this, and so on. And then it becomes really hard, and it's really painful. And then I really yeah. don't like it. The other part I like is having written something. So it's like the two ends of the process, the finding of the documents, and then having written and looking back and saying, wow, that's really nice. I wrote that. I can't believe it. I don't remember writing that. Other parts I don't like as much, but I think, wow, I'm glad it gives me hope for the futures. But it's so hard doing the first draft for me. Some people love the first draft, but I love the successive drafts, the later drafts, the second, the third, whatever, however many, the final touches. I really like that part of it. And so I do like the writing, but not the initial writing. I just find that really hard.
Nice. I think the writing process, everyone has their own struggles, whether it's first draft, second draft.
Right.
But I can tell your enthusiasm for your topics. And I think that is what makes a great writer. So I'm going to link some of your books in the podcast description. Thank you so much for coming on today's show. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thanks for talking.